One of the things I enjoy doing on this program is answering Bible questions submitted to me, so I hope you'll feel free to send me one. And here's one that came my way just recently. Bob, I am deep diving into the subject of prayer, and I have a question regarding 2 Chronicles 7:14, the famous prayer, "If my people who are called by my name." I followed the teaching of a former rabbi, and he had mentioned that much of the Old Testament does not apply to Christians. I believe that I am an heir, according to biblical teaching, in the New Testament. Would it be accurate to use this prayer for America? Okay, well, first of all, let's take a look at this passage. Once again, it's 2 Chronicles 7:14, but let me read the whole thing, and it is probably familiar to a lot of you, because when people are praying for America or whatever country they live in, they view this as a promise of God, that if the land's getting so sinful that people ask God to forgive them, and if there's repentance, then God might pull back and not allow a military dictatorship or communist government to take over their country. Anyway, it says, "If my people, who are called by my name, will humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear from heaven and will forgive their sin and will heal their land." So my friend is asking if this prayer counts for America. If Christians pray this on behalf of their own country today, whether it be America or wherever they live, will God answer it? Or is it, as this rabbi said, something only for Old Testament times, something that only referred to the nation of Israel? This word was given to King Solomon at the dedication of the first temple. And it's true that this passage in Chronicles refers to a promise God gave the nation of Israel specifically. But my friends, here's the thing. God's nature doesn't change. And since Christians have a responsibility to pray for whatever country they live in, I believe we see modern day application. For example, I'm reading now from 1 Timothy chapter 2, the Apostle Paul writing, "I urge then, first of all, that petitions, prayers, intercession, and thanksgiving be made for all people, for kings and all those in authority, that we may live peaceful and quiet lives in all godliness and holiness. This is good and pleases God our Savior, who wants all men to be saved and to come to a knowledge of the truth." There were many Christians in many different churches throughout Greece and Asia that were reading this letter. This letter went to Timothy's church, and then it got disseminated. It was the Roman Empire's government that they were living under. And notice what Paul's saying. Pray for your kings. He means the emperors. He means the governors. Pray for them. And he gives two reasons. One, that we may lead a peaceful life. I always hear this from Christians. Persecution is good for the church. No, it isn't. Now, Paul wasn't afraid of persecution. He got persecuted often, was frequently in prison, and he eventually died under the wicked Emperor Nero. He was not willing to compromise his faith. So Paul is a man that was willing to go through persecution, but he's saying there's nothing wrong with praying for a peaceful life. And then he says this is good and acceptable in the sight of God our Savior, who wants all men to be saved and come to a knowledge of the truth. So a peaceful life is more conducive to the gospel. We live in America, which at the moment, by a thin thread, is still a republic, is still a free country, at least it's supposed to be. It's becoming more of an oligarchy. And the more free we are, the better it will be for the gospel, for the rights of the church. Anyway, was the promise in 2 Chronicles given to Israel specifically? Yes. But in light of this similar admonition in the New Testament, the concept is transferable and very important. This is Bob Siegel making the obvious obvious.
You only need to listen to this radio program once to figure out that Bob has very strong opinions on a wide variety of issues. But one of Bob's strongest passions is freedom of speech itself, even when such speech challenges his own convictions. So feel free to send Bob a comment or a thought-provoking question. You can reach Bob on Facebook or questions@bobsiegel.net. Thank you.
Always good to be joined by my producer, Brendan Thomas.
Hello, Bob. How are you doing today? We're going to look at the 1953 film from Henry Koster, The Robe.
And a little bit of background. Brendan and I, since we do movie reviews once in a while, Brendan and I, behind the scenes, before and after the show, we talk a lot about movies. He had never seen The Robe, so I loaned it to him.
Yes.
And just a couple of weeks ago, he told me that he watched it, he loved it, and he wanted to do a whole show on it.
Yes, absolutely. So, from 20th Century Fox, it runs 135 minutes. Interesting fact about Henry Koster, he was part of the Hollywood 10. For those of you who don't know.
Oh, the blacklisted.
That is correct. Yes, back in McCarthy's days, or the McCarthy era, there was a list of people from Hollywood that were designated as communist, and Henry Koster was accused of being one of those. Obviously, that's not true, and he has gone to direct some of my other great movies I've seen from him. Henry Koster also directed The Luck of the Irish from 1948, Harvey from 1950, one of Jimmy Stewart's underappreciated roles, might I add.
It's my friend, Harvey.
Who was the Saturday Night Live guy that you said did a really good
impression? Dana Carvey.
Dana Carvey
did
it. Fantastic.
Very good.
I can't do it better than him, but he does a really good one. And lastly, The Seeing Nun as well, which is a classic in itself too, I feel like, from 1966. This film stars Richard Burton, Gene Simmons, Victor Mature, and Michael Rennie. The movie cost $4.1 to $4.6 million, and it made $36 million in the box office at the time.
And anybody who's never heard of Michael Rennie, if you've seen the classic 1950s sci-fi The Day the Earth Stood Still, Michael Rennie plays the part of Mr. Carpenter Klaatu, who comes from the other planet.
Oh, that's pretty good. I love that movie too. So,
and does it much better than Keanu Reeves, that idiotic remake.
So overall, I can't remember this Bible story entirely, so I'm just basing this off the movie itself. I was very, very entertained from start to finish of everything. The exposition at the very beginning was very quick and brisk, but you could follow it from word for word of what, everything of the background of the story that I was trying to tell.
Because the people talked like human beings. They weren't talking with these and thous, and that was one of the things I liked about it.
Personally, I don't mind if you put a text up there if you want people to understand the background, especially at the time in 1950s. I know that was probably a big thing that they would do, is put text on the screen to let you know, okay, so here's our background of how the story goes. But the overall narration at the very beginning, fine enough. Just first thing that caught my eye was the cinematography. My goodness, the cinematography is just amazing. The first thing that caught my eye was Marcellus Gallio. Am I pronouncing his name correctly? I believe Marcellus Gallio.
Yeah, no, he's not a real historical figure. He was created for the movie, but you are pronouncing it the way they pronounced it in the
he's
movie.
He's played by Richard Burton.
Excellent job.
Yes, yes. Well, I'll get to him in a second because I do have some things to say about his performance. But Marcellus is walking through the slave auctions, seeing what's going to be up for bid. That one scene of the camera going above his shoulders and you're seeing all the action going across and being able to cut out the sound from one auctioneer to the next auctioneer in one take the entire time. It is really, really awesome. And I really applaud them for that kind of cinematography. Another cinematography, and I also think it's kind of symbolism too, is Marcellus is forced to go to Jerusalem. And I almost felt like that's symbolic for him leaving his sanity as he was going away. It's a foggy thing, and his romantic interest in the movie, I'm trying to remember her name, Diana, that's right. Diana is on the pier, and she's watching as the boat slowly goes into the distance, and it's a foggy distance memory. I almost felt like that was symbolic of his insanity, because eventually, once he gets the robe from Jesus, that turns into him becoming crazy.
Yeah, and it was very much a three-act story, because the action's just nonstop, and the pacing's really heavy all the way up to the crucifixion, and then it really slows down in Act 2 when Marcellus is recovering from the experience he had at Golgotha. Then, of course, Act 3 picks up again and lots of action and adventure.
I couldn't agree more.
Very good way to pace a movie.
Hey, I really, really agree. Another thing I wanted to mention, too, is I like how it's not so over the top with everything. A movie I was referring to while watching this movie was The Passion of the Christ. I don't mind that movie, but I think it's really over the top in terms of the violence. Like, it really shows the details of everything, and I personally found that uncomfortable to watch, really. In this movie, it's one simple blood drop from Christ being on the crucifix, and that right there tells me enough right there, like, oh man, this guy's really suffering, and he's watching this guy pass away up there on the cross.
Well, Mel Gibson was trying to do something different with The Passion. He just wanted people to see accurately everything Jesus went through, even before he went to the cross. I look at that and I go, that's a movie everybody should see at least once.
I saw it once.
But The Robe, I will watch again and again because of the beauty of the way it was filmed.
I agree. Okay, so now here comes the part where I'm a little bit iffy on Richard Burton's performance. I personally thought he was not crazy enough in this movie. I felt like his performances of being crazy or mad while having the robe have its magical powers on him, it was not very good.
Well, he was so withdrawn and monotone of a character before that I felt that by contrast, he was kind of different when he was going through all those things. But yeah, he was certainly underplaying the role. There is something to be said for underplaying, but he was underplaying.
I will say, too, the way he was delivering his dialogue throughout the movie, besides him acting the crazy parts, it felt like any other 1950s actor could have really said these lines, because he's saying it in a very fast and direct way, like most of those 50s actors did at the time.
Well, that was one thing I liked about it, though, because he just seemed like all of us. He seemed like a regular Joe, and the whole idea was this was really not a story about Christ, but a story about somebody learning about Christ, and we're seeing it all through his eyes.
Okay, that's fair enough. One performance I will mention is Victor Mature's performance. He plays Demetrius, who is at one point Marcellus's slave, but eventually
they become friends.
I thought Victor Mature's performance is fantastic. Now, you told me there's a sequel.
There is a sequel called Demetrius and the Gladiators, and it's not a bad movie, but it's not the brilliant movie that The Robe is.
Would you say he gives the same performance in the second one, probably? In this
He's the same person. It's a little more over the top. In the sequel, he falls from his faith because this girl that he loves, he believes she was killed by the Romans. So he falls from his faith, and Peter returns and restores his faith. It was an interesting sequel, and Caligula, and the actor playing Caligula, is in that sequel. It's worth seeing, and I'm glad they didn't call it The Robe Part 2, but it's not nearly... I like Demetrius. Is it nearly as good as The Robe? No.
Do you own a copy of that
movie? I do. I can give you that one, and you can return that one to me in 6 months. We'll do the same thing we did with The Robe.
Okay. Well, I'll watch it eventually, too, because I really liked his performance. I thought, in terms of when he needed to be somewhat over the top, especially in his dramatic performances, my gosh, I felt like he was extremely
especially savage. That scene where he said, I'll never serve you again, you Roman pig, in the storm. What a dramatic moment
really
that was.
Scene. Yeah. Another scene I really liked from him was when he actually starts following Christ.
When he saw him for the first time and he said, I think he wants me to follow him.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
And wasn't the music phenomenal throughout? It was a great score.
The score was done by Alfred Newman.
Alfred Newman, not to be confused with Alfred E. Newman, the editor of Mad Magazine. It's a completely different Alfred Newman.
He was nominated for 9 Oscars. He was nominated straight times from 1938 all the way to 1960. That is super.
Did you ever see him in the other biblical drama, Samson and Delilah? He plays Samson. Oh, that's a fun one. Okay. If you like Victor Mature, you got to see Samson and Delilah.
Was that also made in the 1950s? That one?
I believe that was also the 50s. That was done by Cecil B. DeMille, who did The Ten Commandments.
In fact, it predates
The Ten Commandments.
Oh, really?
Okay. And it has all that, you know, you see the whole Colosseum coming down, the Philistine Colosseum this time, not the Roman.
Okay.
It's worth seeing.
Okay. Also, I just want to mention 9 Oscar wins for Alfred Newman. This one was not even nominated. That was insane to me because this music is fantastic from start to finish.
Yeah, now the movie was nominated for Best Picture of the Year. Richard Burton was nominated for Best Actor, did not win, but he did win that at the Golden Globes, and the movie won Best Picture of the Year at the Golden Globes.
That's correct, yes. Some other scores that Alfred Newman did, I just want to point out the ones that I did watch. Airport in 1970, although I don't suggest watching that movie. That one is a very boring movie to sit through.
The movie Airport?
Yeah.
Oh, I liked that movie.
You did?
Maybe
it's just me. Airport.
Well, that was,
back
you got to understand,
day.
That was a huge bestseller novel. And, well, there's so much dumb stuff that's going on at airports now. Probably wouldn't enjoy the movie as much now.
Dave Stahl, before you said, you know what? Traveling on the planes as of late has been less fun as a friend. I couldn't agree more.
I used to love it. I used to have an evangelistic itinerant ministry where I went all over the country and I loved flying on planes. I loved the adventure. I loved the excitement. There's nothing about it that I like anymore.
Surprisingly, I like road trips better.
I like road trips too. My favorite is to take a cruise along Highway 1 all the way up along the ocean the whole way. I love road trips.
Oh, okay. Some other movies that Alfred Newman did as well was The Keen and I in 1956. I've seen that one too, and that's a really, really nice movie as well. And lastly, South Pacific. I've only seen the musical.
Yeah, now, of course, these musicals, King and I and South Pacific, it's Rodgers and Hammerstein that wrote the book and the music and lyrics, but Alfred Newman was doing the background score and the variations. And that's a very important part of a movie.
Of course.
Music adds so much.
Of course. So also I want to mention that Leon Shamroy was the cinematographer for the movie. He has 4 Oscar wins and 14 nominations, including this film. It was nominated for Best Cinematography for a color film. Back in the day, they separated the 2 categories for color films.
Yes, because there were so many black and white still.
Yeah, but some movies that I've only seen 2 films from Leon Shamroy. Cheaper by the Dozen, the old one from 1950.
That was good. I liked that
movie. I do like the movie, but I don't remember the cinematography being anything special, per se. But the one I know you and I will agree with a lot. He also did the cinematography for Planet of the Apes from 1968.
Oh, I love the original Planet of the Apes with Charlton Heston. What a great movie.
Right now, I'm just jumping into excitement right now, just thinking about
it. And you know who wrote the screenplay for that? He didn't write the original novel. That was Pierre Boulez, who wrote Bridge Over the River Kwai. But the screenplay for Planet of the Apes was Rod Serling of the Twilight Zone. He wrote that screenplay.
I did not know that.
And he put in that ending about the Statue of Liberty because it was different in the book. In the book, he really was on another planet and he came back to Earth. But when he got back to Earth, Earth had been taken over by apes also.
Okay. Was the author alive at that time, by any chance?
That's a good question. I do not know. Okay. He may very well not have been, because he probably wouldn't have liked the way they changed his ending. But once a novelist sells his stuff to Hollywood, there's not much he can do whether he's alive or not.
Because it reminds me, there was a movie made in the 2000s called The Mist, I believe, was the name of the movie. It was done by Stephen King. The original ending had the military save the family in the end, and all the alien creatures in the mist were killed by the military. But in the movie, it's done differently, where they think the monster's about to get them because they hear distant noises of mechanical noises and stuff, and they're not sure if it's alien or something. So the husband says, I will go out and sacrifice myself. You guys need to go out. And we find out that the other family passes away, but he's the only one that survives. And Stephen King actually likes that ending a lot more than the happy ending, because it's a little bit more tragic in the whole thing. So it depends on how you view it, but still, I don't remember reading the book too much. I did read it, but I don't remember the ending too much.
As a general rule, the novel's much better than the movie. There have been a couple of times where I've liked the movie's ending better, but I still feel that out of fairness to the author, they should not have changed it.
Right. But the film of Planet of the Apes, absolute classic, 10 out of 10, obviously would suggest watching.
Oh, and Charlton Heston was the king of the disaster movies. Started with Planet, then he went on and he did The Omega Man, and he did Soylent Green, and just laughed all the way to the bank about Earth's apocalyptic future.
So other things to comment for the movie of The Robe. It also won Best Costume Design for a color film. Absolutely agree.
Oh, of course. A period piece. If they're not nominated for Best Costume, who are you going to nominate?
Right? So I only have 2 more cons, and I have 1 more pro as well to add to this. The other 2 cons, this one's a nitpick. The special effects are a little cheesy here still. I didn't
notice them even trying to do. What special effect were they even trying to do?
There is a blue spirit that goes into the robe eventually that you see in the movie, and I get it.
You're kidding. Now I can't even count how many times I've seen that movie and I've never noticed that.
Yeah, I think it's supposed to be the spirit of God going in there,
but they actually show a blue mist going up.
Yes,
I did not notice that.
Yeah, it's very
quick.
Was
it so subtle that we're...
Yeah, you know, exactly. Wow. But again, it's 1953. I'll give it a pass. There's another scene where both Diana and Marcellus are walking up the stairway to heaven, and it slowly transitions from them inside the palace to them actually going up in the sky to heaven. I thought that transition looked a little cheesy because
and then they start singing the Hallelujah chorus and everything.
But again, 1953, I'll give it a pass. It's a nitpick beyond belief. This is the biggest issue I've ever had with this movie here. It was Jay Robinson's performance of Caligula.
Oh, you didn't like that?
Hated it.
Oh, well,
I absolutely hated it.
It made me hate Caligula, but I guess that made me think that Jay Robinson was being a good actor.
I think Caligula is a very complex character in himself. There was a movie made back in the 1980s.
One dealt more with Caligula's sexuality and stuff. This was more of him being a tyrant.
And even then, that movie is long. Like, I think it's 3
hours. Well, then you may not like Demetrius and the Gladiators, because Caligula's in much more of that from start to finish. edition. He's even more over the top in that one.
I felt Jay Robinson was chewing up the scenery like crazy.
Buying today, Senator Gallio.
He's jumping up and down from his throat.
He needs to be put to death.
Oh, boy.
And then all of a
perhaps
sudden,
the emperor himself makes mistakes.
And then I even close my eyes really, really hard when everyone's doing the I'm Spartacus. No, I'm Spartacus, basically, in the film, where everyone says, kill him, kill him, kill him, kill him. And everyone starts cheering everyone to put him to death at the end for Marcellus and Diana. Because Diana later says, no, if I can't be with him for the rest of my life, then I will be with him the rest of my life up in heaven. Then in that case. So last thing I will say that's really good is overall the production is fantastic as well. I wanted to give some set pieces their due as well. Like, for example, every time they're into an old little living area where it's stone temples or even the actual palace itself where the emperor sits, it is gorgeous. My goodness. Like you said, if a period piece is
That's why it won art direct. That's art direction.
Exactly.
Right there.
If a period piece is not winning art direction or at least nominated for art direction.
Yeah, art direction and costume. It was nominated for other things too, but it certainly deserved those two wins that
right.
it got.
Yeah, it was a beautiful film. Interesting fact before I get into my grade, ABC paid $2 million for its TV rights back in the day, and it broadcasted its first airing during Easter weekend, and it had 31.0 as a Nielsen rating.
That was in 1967, and I was going to share a piece of trivia. I watched that. I was in the seventh grade. I watched it with my parents. You got to catch this. This is a Jewish family.
Uh-huh.
And my Jewish dad explained what a crucifixion was to me for the very first time. Really gave me my first education about Jesus. The same Jewish dad that was later going to disown me when I got into college because I became a Christian.
Mm. So what did you think of it at the first time when you first watched it?
Well, of course, the idea of Jesus dying for a sin, I didn't understand any of that. I didn't believe it. My parents had taught me that the Bible was a bunch of fairy tales, even the Old Testament, even though they were Jewish. But I found it very interesting. I was intrigued by it. And for a while, ABC was showing it once a year, and I always watched it.
Were your parents?
They were allowing me to watch it. Well, they just weren't worried at that time.
Okay.
At that time, they knew that I loved movies and that everybody assumed I was going to go and become some famous writer or something someday. So they weren't worried because they just chalked it up to my love for drama and theater.
Okay.
Now, another thing I did like about the movies, I liked that you never really saw Jesus' face.
I agree.
And you very seldom heard him. Not that we haven't had some good portrayals of Jesus, mm-hmm. but most of them over the years have been horrible.
But also, if you hear Jesus' voice, how comforting is it, actually? I don't remember who was the actor that played Jesus in the film, but his voice is just so inviting and very
I think
nice.
The only time you even hear Jesus' voice is that one time where he says, Father, forgive them. They know not what they've done. I don't even remember hearing Jesus any other time.
I want to say there's one other time at the very beginning where he says hello to Demetrius, but don't...
I don't think so, because Demetrius went out of his way to say he didn't speak, only his eyes spoke.
Okay, so I might be wrong on that one. All I know is that his voice was actually very, very nice for the film.
But I like the effect of who is this Jesus and relating to the people around Jesus. Now, I know that there's new productions like The Chosen where I think the guy that does Jesus does a really good job. But back in those days, when you saw somebody acting Jesus in a movie, they didn't really sell it very well. So I thought movies like The Robe and Ben-Hur did a much better job. Another piece of interesting trivia. One thing I always love, Brendan, is looking at the original movie posters.
Uh-huh.
Now, if you go on Amazon or somewhere and look at the original movie poster, or actually you saw it in the DVD version that I gave you, because sometimes they'll sell a DVD with the original poster, and you look at the three actors drawn on the front, the woman is not Gene Simmons. Now, I don't remember who it was, but there was another actress that was going to play the part. She dropped out at the last minute, and the studio decided not to spend any more money on a new poster. So on there, you're seeing Victor Mature, and you're seeing Richard Burton, and you're seeing some other Hollywood actress. I wish I could remember what her name was, but it is not Gene Simmons.
Okay, interesting. I have to look at that poster.
Just
again.
Little oh. extra worthless, but
no,
hopefully
no,
interesting
no.
trivia.
Yeah, looking back at the cast, I want to also give a compliment to Richard Boone, who plays Pontius Pilate in the film.
Very good job.
Very, just very. One scene. It's just one scene.
But it was very compelling and very believable.
Yeah,
yes.
He's tired. He's exhausted. He has to do
And he's also
so
kind
much.
Of underplaying. He wasn't too much over the top.
I thought it was just perfect.
Yes.
Honestly.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. I agree. He did a I also like Dean Jagger as the weaver, the person that was kind of in charge of that little village at Cana.
Yeah, absolutely. I thought Dean Jagger did an excellent job. And then lastly, I will mention as the interesting fact, too, before my grade as well, is the second highest TV audience for a film behind, can you name the movie? Let's see if you
Bridge Over the River Kwai.
Boom, that's 60 million viewers during that time. So
we've circled back to Bridge Over the River Kwai twice now in this movie with Pierre Boulier, the author writing Planet of the Apes.
So overall, now personally, I like to do my film scores out of 10. So that's me. I am going to give it 8 out of 10. I think it's a very, very good film. I will suggest a lot of people to watch it for sure. And if you want to do it as a letter grade like you do, I'll give it a B. I'm willing to push it up to a B+ as well. Because again, most of my stuff I really find are nitpicks. The biggest issue I had for sure was Jay Robinson's performance as Caligula. But that's just a big nitpick in the whole kit and caboodle of the whole thing. So overall, The Robe, if you could find it on DVD, because it's not available on streaming, you can buy it for $3 if you want.
I'm not as enamored as streaming as everybody else. I would give it an A. And again, you know how critical I am, but if there's a movie we're going out of our way to talk about, it probably means that I like it. So a lot of the movies you hear me talk about on this show, I like. But that's compared to tons and tons and almost anything made today that I don't like.
So yeah, if you can find it on DVD, I don't know if it's on Blu-ray. I'll have to check that. But if you can find it on
DVD. I would like
to
get it on Blu-ray because that would be too. Blu-ray looks so much better than DVD.
I agree 100%. So if you can find it on DVD, I would say I highly, highly suggest you should go out and find it. If it's going to be available on streaming, watch it as many times as you can there if you want. Because I'm personally a streaming guy myself because it's just right there in front of you. Blow off the
dust
first.
It's worth seeing no matter how you watch it.
No matter how you watch it, yeah. Well, unfortunately, we are at the end of our program, Bob. So thank you so much for
this
great
movie. Oh, that was fun. I'm glad you wanted to do it. I love talking about these classics. Okay, folks, we will see you next time. This is Bob Siegel and Brendan Thomas making the obvious obvious.